Fred Film Radio, il cinema ritrovato, Bologna, Italy.
Fred Film Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the 2017 Il Cinema Ritrovato in Bologna, a wonderful festival, and I'm very pleased, very, very pleased to be joined by filmmakers D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus. We're just going to talk movies, although here at the festival is going to be a wonderful screening of Monterey Pop, which we will be talking about in this interview as well, and you'll be doing a program on which is called, I think, Cinema According to D.A. Pennybaker. So that is a very religious...
What do I have to do for that?
This is the first time you've heard about it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah? That's well, it's in the program, so I don't know what happened.
It's the Kevin Brownlow.
Oh, yes. I just thought I'd point it out, because it's a very religious kind of title. You know? I thought it was very unusual.
I know who he is, because I read his book. I read the one book, anyway.
He has a lot of stature in the cinema.
Yes, yeah. Kevin Brownlow is always around. He's a great figure of film history and, you know. And stuff.
He was the first one that ever brought up the problem of the distance between the screen and the back of the theater affecting the sync of the sound.
And sync sound is something that you know about
a
lot. Well,
I know only because we had to somehow lick it in order to make our camera work. That was the big problem of the camera, was getting it to be sync. And a portable sync camera didn't exist before that. The Arri, all those cameras were great cameras. They were war cameras, but they didn't worry about sound.
Yeah, but in Monterey Pop, you were actually on the stage. Sync sound was very important to get that energy.
The film that I'd seen, which was about a concert, was the one on Newport, and it was shot with 35. I knew the guy who did it. I met the guy who did it. I didn't know him very well. But it had to set up a 35 camera on a tripod, and it had to be set back about half a football field away from the performer. Because it was so you used a long lens, a telephone lens. So it was a kind of telephoto view of performers who you had heard on records, which is, in a sense, very close and intimate. So it was not... It was not the best way to show performers at a festival, I didn't think. And plus, they didn't show whole songs. And I thought, if you're going to have a performer sing a song, they should always sing the whole song. Otherwise, you weren't at a... It wasn't like going to the...
What about Don't Look Back?
Right.
Well, that's a different problem, and that was because I didn't want to make a musical film. I was trying to not make a concert film, and I had thought maybe that Grossman, who was Dylan's manager, had wanted me to do that. Well, he never said anything. He never suggested any kind of way of filming or any kind of film. He just said, "Would you like to come with us and make a film?" Or he didn't even say that. He said, "Would you like to come with us?" Knowing that I was a filmmaker, that's why I'd go. I'd make a film. But he never suggested what kind or anything. So that didn't come up. And it wasn't the problem at this point, although it was done before Monterey. The problem was that in order to film a festival, you had to have a portable camera that you could go everywhere with. In the dressing rooms, on stage, you had to see what a person would see who went there. I mean, in a way, you're a substitute for going there. And that's what I knew from the beginning. And I thought, you know, what you don't need are very professional cameramen.
Right.
What you want are people who know how to use this camera and are... kind of know the music of the time. I don't know, you want a person who was very ordinary in a way.
Yeah.
You didn't want a person who spent a lot of thought on how to get the picture right. And so there was one really professional camera woman, which Leacock was my partner.
Oh, yeah.
And the rest of us were just people who know how to turn the camera on and off. And it was as simple as that.
Well, actually, it's funny you mention that, because tonight's screening is going to be preceded by a program of the Lumiere brothers, and I think that there's some comparisons between your works. And because I find, like, you know, the Lumiere brothers, the beautiful thing about it is that they may not have been the best cinematographers, even though they were the first, you know, but they tried to capture reality, the beauty of the simple things in life, really. I mean, they weren't too concerned about getting too
complicated. Besides the moon picture, what other pictures did they make? I don't.
The moon picture was Méliès. So this is the Lumiere.
Right.
Lumiere.
That's right. It wasn't Lumiere, right. Okay, I get them mixed. Longuil made me look at some pictures, and I can't remember now which ones they were.
Lumiere did a lot of people in the streets riding bikes in Paris, and just ordinary people.
Yeah. Well, yes, and also, you know, their kid, and, you know, just very simple things, but the people are still watching them now, and they're not, and I don't think they're watching them as historical artifacts. I think they're still delightful pictures, and it was like the beauty of capturing that. Is that also because some things cannot be captured with still photography?
I think that, you know, part of what they did and what we do is history. It's capturing the history of our times, but it's also storytelling as well for us. And, you know, we try to make movies that are as cinematic as the Hollywood films that are featured here for the most part. We have stories and characters and, you know, storytelling arcs in the film as well. But they also remain as real documents of the time. That's really what people were wearing, were listening to. That's what the place was like. And, you know, because of that, I think they have really, intrinsic value. And sometimes the value is more than the feature film, because these are the real people. These aren't the fake story of somebody who elected the president. These are the real people.
Exactly. And speaking of cinematic, that's one thing I've noticed as well about your movies, is that unlike other documentary filmmakers, even you know, really well-known ones, I can think of, off the top of my head, Frederick Wiseman, makes really, really long documentaries. And you guys are always sort of aware of a story, and that it has to be kind of wrapped up within a certain time frame. So you are kind of aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think because Fred is interested in documenting institutions, they have a different kind of timeline trajectory that he's interested in letting kind of a situation unfold, so you understand, you know, what it's like to be there. I think we're much more interested in theater.
Right.
And having our films be like theater, and have characters that you follow and have and watch them go through something in their life that is really transformative.
Interesting.
Well, I thought Rouge's films were sort of like ours. Jean Rouge.
Jean Rouge is fantastic, filmmaker.
Well, he's more an ethnographic person. I mean, he studied the class he had in Paris was, they studied historical evidence of the past and whatnot. And I think he liked to just look at things the way they are rather than explain them. Although, I guess he had I never noticed the narrations because they were all in French, and I didn't speak French that well. So I didn't. But I liked he did the Panther or whatever it was, the last one, I think. That I saw of his, it kind of was, you know, he went out and tried to get pictures of what was there rather than explain what he found.
Right. Yeah.
And I thought I liked that. I liked that about his films.
Yeah, they're great. They're great films, fantastic films. But this historical evidence actually is also can be seen in a film like Monterey Pop, for instance, because it's not only a concert movie, but it's also looking at the environment itself.
Yeah.
I mean, the introduction of the film is not about the musicians themselves as such, although you can see small footage of maybe Janis Joplin in the backstage, or just talking to someone, and so on and so forth. But it's also everyday people just rushing up to see this fantastic concert.
Yeah, the audience, you mean.
Well, yeah.
I think in Monterey, and this is, I think, if you're a documentary filmmaker and you have this kind of privilege of being someplace where it's the beginning of something happening. And Monterey was really the beginning of the whole rock festival genre occurrence. And it was very unique because it also happened at a time where people... felt a lot of togetherness for change, and they were kind of coming together as change, and the artists were at the same level as the musicians. They were all exploring each other. A lot of the musicians didn't know the other musicians, like Jimi Hendrix or The Who from England. Janis Joplin was new. There were kind of, you know, musicians from California, you know, Los Angeles and San Francisco, kind of a divided thing. So they were all watching each other and sitting in the audience, walking in the audience. I mean, you don't see that at a festival anymore. Everything is on separated levels.
No, there's some attempts, but I don't think in that level, I don't think you see that anymore. Yeah. You're right.
So, you know, to be there when something is first happening, and, you know, I think we've tried to do that in several films. I mean, I know that I tried to do it in a film I did, Startup.com, that was at the very beginning of the internet, and people trying to create companies on the internet, and it was kind of the first boom and bust of it. But if you can be there somehow, sense to be there at some moment like that, I think you can have a film that has a real lasting.
I saw that as well in King of Pastry.
That aspect of it could only have been achieved by portable synchronous cameras.
Exactly.
And the reason there hadn't been anything like that before is there hadn't been that camera.
Right. And I was going to say, because that's exactly my question, is going to be, as well as the subjects and the topics, you've got to have the right equipment, and especially with filmmakers such as yourself, there's been a constant evolution of equipment. And
well, the thing is that I've been working at Life before that, and Life had become famous because it had photographers behind closed doors, and they were able to operate because of the small camera, the Nikon and the couple other ones that came, that you could, you didn't have to have a big camera on a tripod to take a picture, which had, that's what cameras were before that. So it copied that concept that Life had introduced of being able to go behind closed doors or behind the scene because you had a camera that was small enough to carry. So a person could take it there. Otherwise, to go in and set up a camera with lights and a tripod meant you had to create the scene itself. You couldn't go out and into somebody else's scene.
It would feel a little more artificial, maybe. More constructive.
Well, it depended what you were after. But if you wanted to see what Jimi Hendrix was like, you had to kind of be there right next to him.
Yeah.
You couldn't be 50 feet away.
There you go. You said a wonderful thing there. You had to be there. And I feel like, you know, with your films, you see that. You were there. Documentaries tend to keep the audience at a distance sometimes. Sometimes even just through the narration. But, you know, it's simple things like that.
Well, the first film that I really made when I worked for Life, which I could see was a real film, was a whole film. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the world is trained to think that 90 minutes is a whole film.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have been trained to 20 minutes or 30, but somehow that's the length that they were. Why they were always that length, I don't know. But that's the length that everybody ended up deciding was a full, was a real film.
Yeah.
And it was out in Santa Monica in Los Angeles, and there was a place out there which was called the Synanon House. And it was a big house on the beach, not off the beach, but on the beach. And in it was maybe 100 drug addicts who had all gone in to get clean, meaning that they had to live off drugs for a long enough period so that their mind didn't say every day, more get some drugs.
Yeah.
And they were a kind of a group that reinforced each other, that helped each other stay off of drugs. And we went out there and lived in that house. I lived in that house for maybe 2 months. And I spent time, and they would go out on the beach and swim and live a beach life without drugs. But they talked about drugs because drugs was for them a kind of social excitement. And it had to be replaced with something, so that within the house they kind of constructed a way of having that excitement with them all the time. And they had these Synanon sessions, Synanon being a mispronunciation of seminar.
Uh-huh.
The guy that didn't get it straight, But in those seminar sessions, there'd be maybe 20 people,
yeah,
and black and white. The mix was totally in the house. There was no question of whether you were a white person or a black person. I mean, there could have been a Chinese person, but I don't remember one. But they were all subject to the having been drug addicts. Mm-hmm. That's what gave them their hold on each other. And in those sessions, anything could be brought up. If somebody there were a number of women in the house and men, and some of the women were even married and married to men in the house.
Mm.
But in a sense, a person could fuck any one of the women, but he had to be ready to talk about it and explain it in one of those seminar sessions.
Yeah.
And that was an important aspect of it, and they all knew that, so that in a way that built the nature of the house within the house. It wasn't that they were ex-drug addicts that made them interesting. It's that they would talk about anything. There was nothing sacred that you didn't have to answer to if somebody put the question to you. But over a period of time, I could see that this one person there, David,
yeah,
who was a trumpet player, and they had a little band. What was his name? The guitar player, Joe Pass. Was a guitar player. He was a terrific, he was really one of the best guitar players in the country at the time. But he had been a junkie, so he was there doing his time. And they had a little four or five person band, and they played a lot of music, and we filmed a lot of the music because that was a kind of center of the house. People would gather and listen to them. And over a period of time, over the 2 months that I spent there, I found that there was a film there about David, who had a wife outside and a child outside, who wanted to leave, and the guy in charge of the house kept saying, "You've got to divorce your wife. You can't survive without that." And he couldn't decide what to do, what he was. You know, he was somehow trapped in this place, paying for his drug addicting, but at the same time, he wanted to be out with his wife, who was very young. It was kind of an interesting story, and that's the story we made. And we made it, and it was a feature film. It's had very little. I mean, I don't know how many people have ever seen it, but
what's it called?
It's called David.
David.
Yeah, and I could see that using portable cameras we had worked out different ways of being able to sync the sound. In the beginning, we didn't have sync sound cameras, but we in our editing systems, we worked out ways of being able to make picture look like it was synced sound, even though it might not have been shot that way. But in the course of it, a film evolved that was like a real film. It had a protagonist, David. It had a band. It had people all undergoing various aspects of trauma. I mean, it was a real movie, and I thought, you know, you could do that with this kind of camera. You don't, and a few, very few people could do it.
Yeah.
You just needed one or two cameras, and that was, and somebody doing sound, Anagra doing sound, and Kadelski came and was interested, and he developed the Anagra that was very portable. I mean, all of it was the germination of a new kind of feature filmmaking, which anybody could do. You didn't need a big studio, you didn't need the lights, you didn't need anything. You could operate in real space.
This is a final question. I heard that, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I've read this and I don't trust everything I read, but you're also working on VR? At the moment,
I did a VR film. Yeah. After we did Unlocking the Cage, which was an animal rights story, somebody in the audience of one of the theatrical screenings we had in New York came up and said they had an idea for a film about a huge problem that most people don't know about in the United States, where we have over 7,000 tigers in the United States, all languishing in backyards and horrible, you know, roadside zoos in different places. And so he wanted to do some type of film about the work he was doing, which was, he is now spending his life, he was in the finance business. He retired and he decided to spend his life rescuing these tigers and getting them to sanctuaries. So I decided it would be interesting to try this new art form, basically virtual reality. So we did a story where we went into a kind of horrible, like a puppy mill, but it was like for tigers, where they're just breeding these tigers so that they could be used as cubs for 4 months, you know, to be padded and get selfies with, and then they're just discarded into these awful places. So he bought out the guy, and it had like 150 tigers and, you know, other big cats, leopards and stuff, and he moved them all into sanctuary. So our story in VR is kind of going in with this whole immersive 360 degree sense into the tiger cages with the tigers, and, you know, following a rescue of tigers.
What's it called?
It's called Rescuing Tigers.
Rescuing Tigers. And how did you like to experience working with VR?
It was fascinating. You have to put your head in a whole different cinematic world, because when you're editing the story, if you want somebody to look over at what's happening behind you, you have to give them a reason to turn their head and go look at that. So sound is very important, because it kind of cues your brain to go, oh, what's happening over there?
Right.
And so in forming the story and editing it, you have to think in this total 360 degree way. It was fascinating. I'd love to do more.
Absolutely. Because as we're talking about unlocking the cage, I feel like that movie, there's something about it in the sense that maybe it really affected you in a way that your subject, while you were working on it, maybe I felt something that, like, it could have been while you worked on it, your mindset changed.
It futurized for me. I began to see ahead in terms of time what the world may be like in 20 years. And my sense was that it would change in regard to our attitude toward animals, that we'd probably by then stopped eating them because it's too expensive, and people will then be eating artificial meat, which is already companies starting out to do. So it's not an unexpected turn. Having animals not being used as food, you begin to look at them in other ways. And one of them is, I think, animals. People will study animals the way they now study power sources and whatnot, and it'll be a whole different world as far as animals are concerned. And that's kind of what I got a sense of.
I think it really, unlocking the cage really changed both of us more than any other film. You know, you always learn something from the films that we make, because we drop into all these strange worlds. And, you know, a lot of times it's just, you know, how people deal with adversity. I mean, certainly that was the case with Kings of Pastry, which watch, you know, these highest level chefs in the world compete against each other and, you know, sometimes fail. And, you know, for the case of Unlocking the Cage, we watched animal rights lawyer Steve Wise, you know, put himself up against the biggest challenge ever, which was to go into a court in the United States, in this case it was New York City, and New York State, and kind of argue that an animal should have a legal right, that an animal should be a legal person, which, you know, at first sounded very bizarre to us, but after going through this journey with him and really understanding animals and spending time, especially with the animals he was arguing for, which were the great apes, and just seeing how like we are to them. I mean, we are the same species. Afterwards, it just seems, you know, incomprehensible that they should not have some kind of legal right to keep them out of, you know, being basically tortured and killed.
Well, now they're things, and we are not. So a child born, no matter if he can't speak or move any part of his limbs, he's protected by law. Mm-hmm. You can't do away with him. An animal you buy and you can shoot him, and he has no protection. So the idea of extending the law to cover certain animals that are in a way as cognitive as we are in many aspects of their lives, it seems kind of logical, but still it's a certain aspect to it that it seems like he's trying to change the world in a way that's not realistic. So he has to live with that. And but he was an interesting man because as a lawyer, he was a dog lawyer. He was a lawyer for dogs, which right away I kind of love him because I love dogs. But there are a lot of people that don't think much about dogs. I'm sure he didn't have a big effect on their lives. But that he was taking this to an ultimate decision, I don't know, it kind of, you discern a kind of passion there that most lawyers don't have.
Yeah.
So you like him. You're on his side, even though he may not, he may fail. You don't care. You're with him.
Right from the beginning, too. I totally agree with that. And I feel like we should end the interview because I'm worried about your lift, although I could talk to you for hours. But I can't, so that's unfortunate. Anyways, so I from war rooms to pastry to animal rights to music, David Bowie, Bob Dylan, Depeche Mode. You filmed it almost all, and I wish I could talk to you about more, but unfortunately that's all the time we have. But I wish you all the best here in Bologna, and best of luck with the screening. Hopefully it doesn't rain.
Dunmurry was where we lived. Dunmurry.
Ah, Dunmurry, that we were talking about the documentary on the DeLorean.
The Kilburn Farm in Dunmurry.
Right.
That's where we were.
Before the interview we were talking about the documentary on the DeLorean, so there you go. So thank you very much for joining us.
Okay.
It was a great pleasure.
Thank you for having
us.
It was fun to talk to you.
Right.
Thank you very much, and keep making wonderful movies. And this is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.